He has a BA from Wesleyan University and a master's and doctoral degree in fine arts from the Yale School of Drama. Professor Cobb teaches courses in theater history, including avant-garde playwrights like Samuel Beckett and 20th century German playwrights like Bertolt Brecht and Heiner Müller. He teaches dramatic literature, theater criticism and theory, and dramaturgy, which I learned means techniques of dramatic composition. So you see, learning can be is indeed a lifelong experience. Okay. In 1991, Jonathan Cobb won the George Jean Nathan Award for Dramatic Criticism, the country's richest and most prestigious prize for a theater critic. Nathan was the leading American drama critic of his time, active from 1905 to his death in 1958. Professor Cobb's first book was Beckett in Performance, for which I believe the Nathan Award was mainly granted. Professor Cobb was a regular theater critic for the Village Voice from 1987 to 1997, and the chief theater critics for New York Press from 1997 to 2001. He has published dozens of essays, articles, interviews, and other writings in the New York Times Book Review, the New York Times Arts and Leisure, as well as in numerous journals devoted to the theater and also in criticism collections of his work. In the late 1980s, Professor Cobb was awarded several grants in support of his studies in Germany. He lived in West Berlin for 2 years, where he began to write about German theater. His book, The Theater of Heiner Müller, the first general study in English about the most important German playwright since Brecht, was first published in 1998. Professor Cobb's latest book is the one he will be talking about today. It's called Great Lengths, Seven Works of Marathon Theater, published in 2011. It was given the George Friedley Memorial Award by the Theater Library Association as one of the best It was given the George Friedley Memorial Award by the Theater Library Association as one of the best performing arts books of 2012. George Friedley was a producer and stage manager, founder and curator of the theater collection of the New York Public Library. It should also be mentioned that Professor Cobb is the founding editor of HotReview.org, the Hunter Online Theater Review. So HOT stands for Hunter Online Theater. This is a new online forum for critical writing about the theater, published by the Hunter College Theater Department and edited by Jonathan Cobb. This nationally recognized journal welcomes reviews, essays, interviews, and dialogues about any aspect of theater, past or present, with an emphasis on contemporary productions in New York City. And I just before leaving, I wanted to read a quote which I found online about referring to Jonathan Cobb's latest book. This is by a person called Martin Puchner at Harvard. Okay. quote, Jonathan Cobb takes us on a tour of monumental theater events which flaunt the rules of economy, Aristotelian and otherwise. Cobb captures these unwieldy marathon productions by skillfully mixing personal experience and scholarly analysis. I read this engaging book in a single sitting and came away ready to join the first theater marathon I could find, unquote. So I am pleased and proud that Jonathan Cobb is today's speaker.
Thank you, Ada, for that wonderful introduction. And thanks to all of you for coming today. I'm happy to see you. So I'm just going to launch in. I'm going to launch in after I put my reading glasses on. Okay. The idea for my book, Great Lengths, dates back to the summer of 2000. I was sitting on a concrete bench at a World's Fair in Hanover, Germany, during one of the 10 intermissions for Peter Stein's 21-hour Faust 1 and 2. And as I was chatting and eating there with some very sociable Germans I'd just met, I was struck with déjà vu. I'd been here before, I felt. I was an international pilgrim to a theater event of extraordinary length and gargantuan ambition, breaking bread with strangers who had suddenly become my comrades merely because of our prolonged exposure to one another and our common interest in a play, which had melded us into an impromptu community. By 2000, I'd been attending theater regularly for 2 decades, in the United States and Germany, to a lesser extent in England and France. But I'd never consciously gravitated to lengthy productions, not even in Germany, where they're very popular. In Hanover that day, I suddenly realized I'd seen more than a dozen of them, some well before I became a theater critic and a professor. During college and graduate school, I'd seen the 8.5-hour novel adaptation, Nicholas Nickleby, by the Royal Shakespeare Company. And I'd seen Robert Wilson and Philip Glass's 5-hour Theater of Images portrait opera, Einstein on the Beach. Later, I saw Peter Brook's 11-hour adaptation of the Sanskrit epic, the Mahabharata. And I saw Ariane Mnuchin's Les Atrides, which was a 10-hour Kathakali-inspired production of 4 ancient Greek tragedies. Among the others I'd seen were Robert Lepage's 7-hour meditation on Hiroshima, the 7 streams of the River Ota, and new American historical dramas by Tony Kushner and Robert Schenkan that shockingly appeared on Broadway, the 7-hour, 2-part Angels in America, and the 6-hour, The Kentucky Cycle. These works were breathtakingly diverse, and at first I wondered whether they shared anything more significant than their great length. Length is, after all, one of those quantitative measures that cultivated people tend to think of as secondary in assessing artworks. We easily accept that size matters in other areas of human affairs. But with works of the imagination, that acceptance is hesitant and contingent. Surely, all questions of content are more urgent and important than the question of how long a play is, or how long a film is, or a musical work, or a novel. A fundamental principle of Western creativity since Romanticism has been that art legislates for itself. Good works are as long as they need to be, no more, no less. Furthermore, in our era, we are so used to seeing mindless yet expensive movies marketed as epics, and inane publicity stunts using the term marathon as an empty gimmick, that we're especially aware that length alone guarantees nothing. As I mulled things over, though, I saw reasons why these diverse productions fit meaningfully together. For one thing, they'd all played havoc with normal play-going routines. They were endurance feats for their audiences as well as their performers, holding us in our seats for whole days at a time, whole evenings at a time. Sometimes these plays immersed me in a conjured world so deeply that I felt transported to a different time space. And despite my aching muscles, I was actually very sorry when the piece ended. For another thing, these long works offered rare and precious experiences of sustained meditation. Each one was in a different way a tonic against what sociologists call our era's hurry sickness. This refers to our compulsive multitasking, our 60-second sitcoms, our pop-ups within pop-ups, our epidemic attention deficit disorder. Most of us suffer this sickness in isolation, sitting in front of various screens. But these theatrical marathons offered relief from that too. Most of them took place in specially outfitted theaters or unusual out-of-the-way locations that people had to trek to, like a quarry or an island or a converted factory, or a warehouse, or a World's Fair. And there they generated an uncommon sense of public communion that transformed throngs of atomized consumers into congregations of skeptical co-religionists, or at least commiserating co-sufferers. Great Lengths is the fruit of my effort to understand how and why this process works. The book is organized as a series of six essays about seven marathon productions that I saw between 1980 and 2009, most of which were sold to the American and European publics with massive and vulgar publicity campaigns as sensational media events. Nevertheless, all of them were, in my view, artworks of major stature, which sustained my belief that the theater still occasionally serves great masters. My subject is really a special class of experience that I'll discuss in a historical context in a minute. A full-length theatrical experience for us in the Western world is normally about 2 or 3 hours long, and it has been that length for centuries. My book deals only with works longer than 4 hours that earned their length artistically, works that clearly needed their length to accomplish extraordinarily ambitious aims, and that furthermore needed the theater. We're all painfully aware of the ubiquity of unbearable long theater, productions that are merely prolonged due to egomania or ineptitude or indiscipline or some other failing like that. I'm not interested in those commonplace examples. I just set them aside for the sake of some unforgettable exceptions, and the one I've selected to discuss in a bit more detail today is Einstein on the Beach, which was just revived in September for the third time at BAM. Lengthy productions place the theater under unique pressure. They're unforgiving crucibles from which artistic ideas and approaches emerge either hopelessly broken and disproved or unforgettably bright and persuasive. The theater is more itself in a marathon production, you could say, because it has the chance to realize essential powers and potentialities that shrink away from view when the art has to conform to the needs of a conventional evening length. So, here's my short historical passage. Lengthy theater is certainly nothing new. Audiences in ancient Athens watched tragedies and comedies from dawn until dusk during the dramatic competitions of the City Dionysia Festival. During the late Middle Ages in Western Europe, ordinary townspeople attended and helped stage elaborate outdoor productions of biblical plays that lasted an entire day or more in conjunction of the holiday of Corpus Christi. Numerous Asian theater traditions have always involved all-day or all-night performances. The modern Western drama canon includes many long works, such as Goethe's Faust, or Wagner's Parsifal, or Ibsen's Brand and Peer Gynt, O'Neill's Strange Interlude, Hawkhuth's The Deputy. Lengthy theater is in no sense a historical aberration. It's a sporadic occurrence that has different social causes and artistic causes at different times. Furthermore, interestingly, the impulse to establish a norm of dramatic length also dates back to antiquity. Aristotle spoke about it in his Poetics, which is the founding document of Western dramatic theater theory, written in the 4th century BC, and he employed a nature metaphor. Beauty depends on size and order, Aristotle said. Hence, neither can a very tiny creature turn out to be beautiful, since our perception of it grows blurred as it approaches the period of imperceptibility, nor can an excessively huge one, for then it can't be perceived all at once, and so its unity and wholeness are lost. If, for example, there were a creature 1,000 miles long. So, just as in the case of living creatures, they must have some size, but one that could be taken in a single view, so with play plots, they should have length, but such that they're easy to remember. The core principle behind this ideal is unity. A good drama is one that can be surveyed completely as an organic whole. It shouldn't be too short, Aristotle says elsewhere, or it will lack magnitude. But it mustn't be too long or excessively huge, so much that its incidents can't be held in memory all at once. The Poetics says that drama is a superior form to epic precisely because it has greater unity and concentration. This principle of unity has been of overwhelming importance in Western theater. And the pervasive influence of the Poetics is the main reason why good plays have always been considered models of creative efficiency in the West. Aristotle's Poetics, though, wasn't well known in antiquity, and it may originally have been nothing more than a contribution to a private academic debate among students in his school. The most curious aspect of the Poetics, for my purposes, is that the book has nothing to say about the performative context of drama in classical Greece. I'm referring to the festival environment of the city Dionysia that is clearly the most illuminating frame in which to view the Athenians' custom of spending whole days in the theater. The city Dionysia festival was the largest and the most prestigious occasion for drama in ancient Athens. This festival started in the 6th century BC and continued for 700 years. It was an elaborate and an expensive week-long affair, so important to the city that it continued even through the worst dangers and depredations of the Peloponnesian War. The festival included 4 days entirely filled with plays, and it had other purposes also. It was scheduled in the spring when the local harvest was complete and people could afford to leave work, and when sea travel was easy and Athens was teeming with foreign visitors. It included ritual celebrations of the god Dionysus and ceremonies that Athens wanted the rest of Greece to witness, such as the garish display of tribute payments by territories Athens had conquered and the formal presentation of state-funded armor to young men whose fathers had died fighting for the city. Wealthy Athenians considered it an honor to underwrite this patriotic event by financing one of the competing playwrights. And the conduct of those sponsors was publicly judged after the festival, as was the behavior of audiences. The city Dionysia was part of what the scholar Rush Rame has called a pervasive performance culture in Athens, comparable to an ongoing feast. Athenians devoted more than 100 days each year to such festivals, which were their chief form of religious observance, and they considered them integral to the ongoing life of the city. The festivals typically began with a formal procession, a sacrifice, and a feast, followed by contests of some kind, such as an athletic event, or musical competitions, or drama competitions, at which the audiences acted as the judges. The religious festivals, in other words, were very much part of the participatory and argumentative spirit of the agora, the public commons, just as the democratic institutions of the assembly and the law courts were. Those institutions, in turn, the assembly and the law courts, were inherently theatrical. They were large public gatherings in which orators proposed civic and military policy or debated legal adversaries, standing up in front full of large amphitheaters full of their compatriots who listened and judged. So the long hours that the Athenians devoted to drama in the city Dionysia were part of a solemn and religious obligation. The plays were an occasion for communal reckoning that happened also to be a form of mass entertainment. They were like today's pop concerts or sporting events, but with a serious purpose. The crowds were immense, 12 to 15,000. And the stage effects had to be crude rather than intimate because of the distance. But the plays weren't crude. The winning works of the competitions were praised for the subtle arguments in language And the spectators brought food and wine to sustain them through the long days. And they vocally expressed approval and disapproval of specific passages and turns of events as they occurred. The Athenians lingered in their theater because they cherished this form for contemplating what they owed to one another and to their gods as citizens, as critics and judges, and as fellow humans. It's remarkable that 2.5 millennia later, our notions of modern tragedy still strongly reflect this deliberative performance concept. Despite Aristotle, our views of the tragic today generally form around the notion of recognized and shared suffering, of communal bonds forged by transcendent expressions of suffering and its inevitability for human beings. Here's what Peter Stein said about this in 2005. The essence of human existence consists in a paradox, that the human being is born to die. Death and birth belong together. That's why one can also say that the only human being who can be called happy is the one who was never born. Tragedy draws its life from this contradictory statement. It gets right to the point of the paradoxical essence of life. And it's obviously only possible to speak the truth about this with the mendacious, peculiar fictional methods of the theater. When I interviewed Peter Stein in 2007 for my book, I asked him what experience he hoped people would have generally in his long-duration productions, because he had already done half a dozen of them. And his answer was, to have a theater day. I wanted them to have a theater day. Clearly, I took all the inspiration from Greek tragedy, because Greek tragedy was always organized as a theater day. It's extremely curious that Aristotle went to the trouble of defining ideal dramatic length without ever mentioning this circumstance of the theater day. He was well aware that the tragic playwrights in the city Dionysia were each required to present 4 plays, 3 tragedies and a satyr play, on their assigned day of competition. But the Poetics, his great work on tragedy, says nothing about the unity of the daily programs. So we're left with a paradox. The theorist who enshrined the concise, efficient, Sophoclean form as the Western world's ideal dramatic structure watched dramas as part of extravagant, multi-part, all-day affairs. Corpus Christi. The Corpus Christi cycle plays of the European Middle Ages were made by people who didn't know anything about Aristotle. And in fact, the plays had nothing like the unity of ancient tragedy. These lengthy theater events began in the late 14th century, and they flourished in numerous countries for about 200 years. They were most popular in England. They were called mysteries, in homage to the craft guilds that produced them, because each profession considered its expertise a mystery. And they were annual, all-day affairs, sometimes multi-day affairs, that enacted the entirety of divine history from creation to doomsday in a series of biblical episode dramas. Each episode was produced by a different team and performed on a separate pageant wagon with a mostly separate cast, and the overall cycles were patchwork compositions by multiple authors who added plays to the sequence over many years, almost never bothering to adjust the older plays to the new plays. The reason these works have exerted such a powerful grip on the Western imagination is their participatory zeal. They represent the first major flowering of drama in vernacular languages in Western Europe after its almost complete disappearance for about a millennium. And that is what made them such powerful wellsprings of inventive energy. By allowing these plays, the church opened emotional floodgates that had long restricted theatrical enjoyment and creativity in the lay public. That public, mostly illiterate, burdened by drudgery, disease, poverty, and exploitation, had seen theater in churches at least since the 12th century. But that theater consisted of somber liturgical dramas chanted in Latin by priests and monks. Corpus Christi transferred the production responsibility to the people, and allowed them to perform in their own languages. The holiday was established in 1311 as an early summer celebration of God's gift of the Holy Sacrament to mankind. And as it evolved into a week-long festival, it became the first large forum for plays in local languages outside churches since Roman times. The texts were written by church officials and organized by municipal authorities, but they were produced lovingly and skillfully by local craft and trade guilds, and they were acted by ordinary men and women from the local populace. Their preparation and performance were a prized annual period of playful release from the grim routine of the commoners' everyday lives. The plays used Bible stories to illustrate the repeated miracle of salvation despite sin, in case after biblical case. And they were saturated with exciting and sensational hocus-pocus effects, realistic local color and humor, and knockabout excitement. The scenes were all set in the current era, even though they were Bible stories, because no distinction was made between historical periods. And that, too, gave the audiences an intense connection to the performances. These cycles were objects of intense civic pride and rivalry between communities. The main reason these cycles stand out so sharply in theater history is that they consumed the attention and energy of entire English towns for days. The Cornwall and Chester cycles each took 3 days to perform. The 48-play York cycle, the longest one we know of, began with a gathering of pageant wagons at 4:30 a.m., after which the wagons proceeded through the streets and stopped to present their plays in sequence at 12 prearranged stations where refreshments and other accommodations were provided by businesses that paid a fee to locate the stations there. This cycle lasted at least 15 hours, ending at dusk, or, as one source claims, continuing in torchlight until after midnight. No matter what religious view you take of the motivation for this tradition, the scale of the communal exertion stuns. These medieval Christians were no slavish agents of authority. They were acting on their own passionate need to play and to reassure themselves about God's master plan for humankind. That is why they created a theatrical immersion experience in which they could imagine themselves as players in the grand historical drama of man, whose promised end was the permanent end of their misery in the final judgment. It was during the era of rising secular drama that followed the mysteries, the late 16th century, that the general expectation began in the West that theater performances should normally be 2 or 3 hours long. A few lengthier traditions continued beyond that in religious contexts, but for the most part, this lengthy theater faded. It was a casualty of the Reformation and the increased availability of professional theater. Protestantism was a big factor because it introduced a new ethic of efficient use of time, as well as a mistrust of idleness. But increased professionalism was just as important. Lope de Vega, who's considered the perfecter of the three-act Spanish form, the Comedia, kept almost all his plays to within the 2 or 3 hour limit. And in his one theoretical text on playwriting, published in 1605, he recommended that length as a rule, saying that's all the patience that audiences have. Shakespeare's Globe Theater, which thrived as a business just outside the London city boundary in the late 16th and early 17th century, had performances beginning at 2 p.m. and ending around 5. Same thing, 2 to 3 hours. Since the time of Lope and Shakespeare, this norm of 2 to 3 hours has been one of the most durable conventions of the Western theater. It survived the advent of the bourgeois theater in the 18th century and the development of leisure as a respected sphere of fulfillment separate from work. It survived the insatiable thirst for mass popular entertainment in the 19th century with that march of more and more spectacular stage effects. And it generally survived the rise of egotistical directors in the 20th century, though they, as a group, are its most consistent challenge today. One figure I ought to mention who stands between Shakespeare and Lope's age and ours is Richard Wagner, Wagner's music dramas not only tend to be long, they're also the most elaborate effort yet made in the modern theater to recreate the experience of communal unity and tribal reckoning of the ancient Greek theater. Wagner wanted to assuage the spiritual hungers of what he saw as a deracinated, commercial-minded, industrial-age public in the 19th century by appealing to them through myth. He thought myth would tap their higher instincts and bind them more strongly together as a folk. He also hoped his epic-scale theatrical productions would heal the split between the separate arts, poetry, painting, dance, and music, that supposedly occurred back in ancient Athens when the Athenian state fell. The festival that Wagner founded in Bayreuth became the prototype for countless other arts festivals in the 19th and 20th centuries that had the same lofty aim as his, of raising the stakes for culture beyond diversion for the tired businessman. In fact, when I started to ponder the reasons why marathon theater events have proliferated and flourished in our time, the first reason that came to mind was the proliferation of arts festivals. During the post-World War II period in Europe and America, many deindustrialized cities founded summer festivals in order to rebrand themselves and encourage tourism. Lengthy theater by famous directors grabbed headlines and attracted thousands of outsiders to the festival host cities. Einstein on the Beach began at the Avignon Festival in 1976. The Mahabharata began at the Avignon Festival in 1985. And very few years have gone by since the 1980s without some lengthy work topping the bill at Avignon and Salzburg and Spoleto and Edinburgh and the Lincoln Center Festival and the BAM Next Wave Festival. The international stardom of these directors, Robert Wilson, Peter Brook, Ariane Mnuchin, etc., is also one explanation of why marathon theater has flourished in recent decades. In their early years, the post-war theater festivals competed for star actors. But beginning in the 60s and 70s, directors became the sought-after stars of these festivals, at least in Europe. This was due to the new ethos of director's theater, whose heroes commanded great prestige and critical attention, which in turn won them the power and financial backing to realize enormous projects. Marathon theater doesn't necessarily require star directors and lavishly subsidized institutions. Nicholas Nickleby was an ensemble creation by a very frugally subsidized British institution. Angels in America and the Kentucky Cycle were both playwright-driven projects developed at American regional theaters. And you know how well-funded they are. What binds all of this exceedingly diverse contemporary marathon theater together, I think, is the opportunity it has provided for thinking theater-goers in the media age to resist the maddening, ubiquitous, and nearly irresistible pressure to reduce, abbreviate, and trivialize. Our era has notoriously minuscule attention spans, and time has generally become more valuable than money for the social class that attends high-profile theater. Yet, that class needs occasional relief from the image swarm, from the split screens and quick cuts and bullet lists and call waiting that keep it caffeinated. It's no coincidence that long productions tend to occur in the summer, as their slowed-down experience of time replicates benefits that many people seek in vacations, such as traveling with other people to share common experiences with them, or watching long baseball games, or relishing elongated days to commune with nature, or read long novels. Novel reading may be the activity most comparable to marathon theater. We often hear that doorstop novels are an antiquated artistic form because their demands don't fit the rush-rush postmodern lifestyle. The irony is that their authors still sell thousands of copies every year, suggesting that many people still have the impulse to immerse themselves, even if they ultimately fail in the act. So much around us is perforce distilled and fragmented that I think we long for the fullness of comprehensively conceived worlds. I think we long to lose ourselves in elaborate and epic story arcs, savor panoramic vistas, and ponder quixotic concepts of the monumental. We would do all this as readers if we had the time, or if we could concentrate, or stay awake. But the truth is, it's easier for us to do it watching theater, or watching film or television for that matter, since excellent long-format works have also proliferated in film and television in our time in response to the same need. I'm thinking of marathon films by directors like Fassbinder or Zuberberg or Jacques Rivette. And I'm thinking of film-like television serials like Lost or The Sopranos or Mad Men or Breaking Bad that extend plot arcs over 8 hours of viewing time or more. The crucial difference between watching long-duration works on media and watching them in theater is in the nature of the communal experience. Because theater confronts us with the physical real-time presence of toiling performers as well as fellow audience members, it provokes a greater awareness of the body and of the ticking clock of mortality than recorded performances can. Theater's signature feature is the palpable exertions of living performers, striving to breathe life into dramatic artworks for our sake, replenishing our energy with their energy as we watch them. And the inherent gravity within the theater's basic circumstances, I think, even in a comedy, even in something like circus, helps explain why theater audiences are generally less mentally passive than film and TV audiences. I have attended two public screenings of Zuberberg's seven-hour film, Our Hitler, a film from Germany, which was made in 1977 and which I think is a masterpiece. Not once during those 2 day-long screenings did I feel my bodily exhaustion transforming into exhilaration, as it often did during my days with Nicholas Nickleby, Einstein and the Beach, Angels in America, and Faust 1 and 2. Nor were the cinema spectators particularly sociable during the screening breaks. The essential difference was in the film audience's inherent passivity. They lacked engagement with the energy of living performers, and they were much more inclined to hypnotic immersion, which they couldn't simply shake off when the lights came up. So my main underlying interest in writing my book was to investigate how we screen-obsessed secularists might reconceive the monumental in a post-monumental era, and how we might actually achieve some fleeting moments of sacred public communion comparable to what our ancestors experienced at the Corpus Christi Festival and the City Dionysia Festival. Einstein on the Beach was the most surprising example along these lines that I encountered in all my years of theater going. This piece was first made in 1976, as I said, by Robert Wilson and Philip Glass. I first saw it in its first BAM revival in 1984, and it is still today the only theater work I have seen that sustained my interest and attention over a marathon length of time without having a substantial text. Einstein on the Beach is a sophisticated work of childlike simplicity. It has no coherent narrative, and it's constructed as a prolonged waking dream in which anything can happen at any time. And as you watch it, you soon stop expecting or even wanting logical continuity from it. All of Einstein's scenes are lucid, simple, and accessible on the surface. A train moves slowly on and off as people dance next to it, and a little boy up above tosses paper airplanes from a derrick. A trial with two judges wearing wigs, an old man and a boy, takes place beside a giant geometrical bed where a witness, originally played by the choreographer Lucinda Childs, this is her, lounges and chatters away as a clock above her is obscured by a black disc as if by an eclipse. The more you ponder these pictorial riddles, the more they resist interpretation. The work is a rhapsody to right brain apprehension. It's an anomalously systematic celebration of association, connotation, metaphor, and tone. Einstein doesn't entirely exclude language. It treats language as trivial, whimsical, and irrational. Disconnected texts, nonsense stories, and advertising twaddle are repeated ad nauseum. Lyrics consist only of counted numbers, 1, 3, 5, and solfège syllables, you know, do, re, fa, so. Before I saw this so-called portrait opera for the first time, I'd read quite a bit about it because it was already legendary. I expected its strategy of devaluing language and logic to be irritating, just an alibi for shallowness. In the event, it wasn't, because it never seemed evasive or facile. The whole production was painstakingly constructed, and nothing essential in it originated in language. The moving images weren't any sort of mime or graphic art that grasped after narrative. Knowledge in this world clearly stemmed from line, shape, movement, musical expression, not from words. The impetus of the train scene, for instance, was obviously a simple fascination with relative speed. Lucinda Childs,
there she is,
merrily wrote in the air with chalk while walking back and forth obsessively along a diagonal line. As the giant two-dimensional steam locomotive behind her took 20 minutes to move about 20 feet. Numerous other dancers moved methodically in somewhat faster slow motion. And the boys' paper airplanes dropped from the derrick above in slavish obedience to Newton's gravitational law. The work's ostensible subject was Albert Einstein, represented not biographically or historically, but poetically through dance, image, and music. There are biographical tidbits in the show, but they don't provide much illumination. All 24 cast members wear the tennis shoes, white shirt, and neutral colored pants and suspenders that Einstein wore in famous iconic photos. And some of these photos were projected behind the actors. That's one of them there. A solo violinist in an Einstein wig and mustache plays downstage on a chair in the center for most of the action. And his position seems to mediate between the stage and the audience. Einstein was an amateur violinist, and this figure in the opera comes off as a sort of cicerone or stakeholder for the place of music in the dramatic universe. Can I play that piece of music now? I want to play you a snippet of music. This is Philip Glass's music. Music takes the reins in Einstein on the Beach more authoritatively than in any other music theater piece I know, including Wagner's music dramas. The whole 5 hours of Einstein are through scored, as in grand opera. But because the verbal text doesn't have its usual governing function, the music, along with Wilson's pictures, takes over as the main organizing principle. This score by Philip Glass is cyclically hypnotic and relentlessly repetitive. One critic said it permeates the theater like sonic weather because it warms and cools and sweeps everything along in its shifting breezes and gales. The music is already playing when the audience enters the house at the beginning. You can turn it off now. But when you enter, it's just a slow, droning sequence of three organ notes. Ba, ba, ba. And each of those notes is held like a minute, and then 30 seconds, and then 15 seconds. And in the meantime, these two young women in a square of light off to one side are slowly tapping their fingers as if on invisible keyboards and speaking numbers into their head mics. 2, 3, 4. By the curtain time, a polished vocal chorus, all dressed as Einstein, has joined them, and their voices rise together with the amplified organ to a majestic crescendo of song numbers and do, re, mi syllables. They sing this chorus, with all the soaring exuberance of a hallelujah chorus. And the rest of the evening proceeds in the same vein. The two leading women, originally played by these women, Lucinda Childs and Cheryl Sutton, are treated as protagonists in mysteriously enigmatic dramas, whose emotional peaks and valleys are defined by the music and not the texts. And though the music is systematically rigorous, it ends up providing a warmth that thaws the chilly geometry of Robert Wilson's pictures. The music is lushly orchestral, as you can hear a bit in that clip, and the vocals resemble anthems and elegies and odes to unnameable objects. The focus and endurance of both the Philip Glass ensemble and the cast are astonishing. For long stretches of the action, the physical movement is so slow and the music so repetitive and chant-like and anesthetic that many spectators, doze off in their seats. Other spectators flee to the lobby, and they were given permission to do that in the program, which has a note that reads, "As Einstein on the Beach is performed without an intermission, the audience is invited to leave and re-enter the auditorium quietly as necessary. The food service in the lobby will remain open during performances." For people who don't go to the lobby and stay watching the piece, there is no way to avoid falling into reverie, boredom, trance, or meditation, at least occasionally. The big left brain question is, meditation on what? The question of meaning inevitably looms over the work, as your mind is drawn to try to understand the sense in which Einstein is being used as a trope. You can't help but seek connections between Wilson's precise pictures and Lucinda Child's formalistic choreography and Glass's repetitive music. There is synergy between the elements of Einstein. You can feel it, but pinpointing it and naming it are not so easy. Time is certainly one major theme. Einstein famously drew new associations between time and speed, and the performance makes time feel plastic and malleable, like a material that a clever artist could manipulate, like paint or sound or light. Another obvious theme is the human costs of science and the scientific age. The trial scenes seem to place all of humanity, Einsteinian humanity, in the dock for mysterious unnamed crimes. The music's mathematical rigor poses implicit questions about the dreadful effects of mechanistic process. And this is the trial scene. An image of a mushroom cloud appears near the end. Space travel, too, becomes a locus of mystery and anxiety. A small model spaceship travels across the stage on a wire during the piece's two long dance sequences. It's a harmless toy. But in a final scene that is tumultuous, the spaceship grows ominous as the performers become cogs and drones, standing like manic automatons working brightly lit geometrically patterned controls in what you assume is the spaceship's interior. A lot of the production doesn't fit any of the themes that I just mentioned. The evening was sprinkled with silly non sequiturs, such as when dancers enter clutching odd objects, like a newspaper or a seashell, and moments when the chorus pauses to brush its teeth or check its watches. In one of the trial scenes, a coffee break is plunked in the middle. This comes about 90 minutes into the opera, and when it happens, it feels as if the cast have become surrogates for the audience. They need a coffee break. Incongruous topical references also crop up, such as pop lyrics from Carole King, and a scene when Lucinda Childs dresses as Patty Hearst, the heiress turned bank robber, which was a hot news story in 1976. Huge amounts of journalistic energy were expended trying to interpret these crumbs in 1976. Still more energy was expended pondering whether Einstein was really an opera or really an avant-garde hoax. For me, in 1984, seeing my first Robert Wilson work, this show was an avant-gardist redemption because it revived my belief that the legacy of Wilson's older generation of theater experimenters could still be exciting and provocative. Einstein melted my resistance in the course of the evening. It taught me how to appreciate it, how to accept and read its nonverbal strategies as a form of writing. Jean-Paul Sartre once said that the utopian symbolist ideal of a theater of silence was itself kind of a hoax. This putative theater of silence, he said, really amounted to, quote, pan-verbalism, the total conquest of the theatrical world by the word, because words ended up defining the nature of everything around them, including the empty spaces. I was, in 1984, and for the most part still am, an unregenerate Sartrean on the question of theatrical language. I've always felt that language, when it's present at all, always manages to seize control on the stage. It always manages to establish the ground against which everything else is seen, even if that power sometimes works by default, as in Samuel Beckett. Words, it's always seemed to me, simply won't tolerate being merely one element among many in a composite stage language with equal power to that of gesture and color and form and sound. Einstein confronted me with proof of the opposite. It was a patently eloquent and profound work in which words tolerated exactly what I thought they couldn't. There's many sequences in the piece that I could use to illustrate this point, but I've chosen one that made the strongest impression on me. Einstein had 9 scenes of a half hour or so, divided into 3 cycles that repeated and transformed 3 different visual and musical themes. The visual themes were a train, a courtroom trial, and a field. The train, for example, appeared at first as a side view cutout. Later, it appeared as a 3-dimensional antique passenger car. And then later, as a building shaped and angled exactly like the passenger car. So for my illustration, I'm going to describe the transformation of the trial scenes. The first trial scene, the second scene of the opera, was a gentle satire. It was a droll distillation of the maddeningly slow grind of justice, you might say. The judges declared the court in session 6 times, once in French, never mentioning the name or the nature of the case, as the various players entered in slow, ritualistic procession, took up their ceremonial positions as jurors, witnesses, attorneys, stenographers. These are stenographers in the front. The organ doodled. The jury chorus chanted, fa, so, fa, so. This handless clock above the judges hovered like a mysterious hieroglyphic tablet until the black disc slowly blocked it out. Time seemed to drip onto everything heedlessly, including onto this bed, center stage. Meanwhile, Lucinda Childs, who is a strong, lithe, sharp-boned dancer, sat sculpturally in this 8-foot-tall witness chair while someone else recited a baffling nonsense text. The next trial scene, about 90 minutes later, had more of a sense of purposefulness and individual human agency, but it was still thoroughly puzzling. The stage was split in half, with the courtroom on the left and a prison with bars on the right, where these 2 inmates in striped uniforms performed this kind of jumpy, vaguely antagonistic dance on benches. Lucinda Childs now wore a white debutante dress instead of the generic Einstein costume, and she lolled around on the truncated bed, repeating the following speech over and over again in an eerie, pedantic drone. I was in this prematurely air-conditioned supermarket, and there were all these aisles, and there were all these bathing caps that you could buy, which had these kind of 4th of July plumes on them. They were red and yellow and blue. I wasn't tempted to buy one, but I was reminded of the fact that I'd been avoiding the beach. I was in this prematurely air-conditioned supermarket, and there were all these aisles. Over and over and over again. This was, by the way, the only explicit reference to a beach in the whole opera. After a while, without once pausing in speaking these words over and over, she rose, walked over to those jail bars, and dressed herself as Tanya, the criminal Patty Hearst's alter ego, in black jacket and Tommy gun. So did Cheryl Sutton a few minutes later. Now, when this happened, you couldn't help speculating about connections between Patty Hearst and Albert Einstein. Possibly between Patty Hearst's rejection of her conventional upbringing and the opera's rejection of theatrical conventions, or connections between social criminality and larger scale betrayals of nature, betrayals of God, that sort of thing. But that invitation that the opera seemed to hold out to probe rationally, to inquire politically, was extremely brief and short-lived. In fact, nothing else in the production encouraged it. No reference to Hearst or any other topical subject appeared again, and the half-hour field dance that followed this scene was completely content neutral. Robert Wilson could have picked up this topical thread about 90 minutes later when the pattern of scenes cycled round to what should have been the next trial scene. Instead, he went in a completely different direction. When the next trial scene began, all you saw for more than 3 minutes was an illuminated white rectangle lying horizontally in the dark. After a minute or so, I recognized it as the light bar that had formed the downstage edge of the bed in the previous scene. You see? This shape just shimmered there, while a single sustained organ note purred and then swelled into quick, closely grouped musical phrases, and then it swelled more into excited cyclical keyboard patterns. And then, without warning from the music, the bar began to rise on its edge, lifting up with excruciating slowness into a diagonal and then a vertical position. In the opening train scene, a similar bar of light had split the sky like modernist lightning. Now this standing bar seemed to linger there as a figure of life. At the point it achieved verticality, it became, and I can't explain how I came to be so sure of this, unmistakably anthropomorphic. It was extremely strange for me to find my emotions so powerfully pulled by a simple strip of light substituted for a character. But that's what happened. With that gesture, all the complexities and perplexities of human justice in the opera seemed suddenly absorbed into a pure monolithic form. Absolute presence and absolute absence merged into one, like a pretentious suprematist figure of mystical rebirth, recontextualized as a minimalist gesture of lighthearted self-deprecation. Finally, the bar began to levitate upward, directly upward, accompanied by a fervent soprano voice so beautiful that joined the organ. Ah. It roamed through various pitches and rose in volume until the bar disappeared into the flies. A geometric Hamlet sung to rest by a wordless angel. I remember the catch in the breath of the spectators around me as this scene ended. To me, it had clearly been the climax of the opera, and I assumed that everyone else felt the same way. The bar stood for Einstein, the dreamer, I thought, and the ascension was his apotheosis. It was reverential, even though it was tongue-in-cheek. I was humbled to learn later on that almost no one in the group of four friends that I went to the show with saw things the way I did. All my friends enjoyed the rising bar for their own reasons. No one missed it because they were in the lobby or anything like that. But I was the only one who identified it with Einstein. And I was the only one who thought it was the show's climax. One friend said he thought the show's climax had been the Coltrane-like saxophone solo in the train-shaped building scene. Another friend said the climax was obviously the tumultuous final spaceship scene, because it had a barrage of music and sound and light and dance, including a wonderfully frantic elbow-flailing dance that Robert Wilson performed himself. The fact is, all this disagreement was typical of the work, because when you study Einstein on videotape, you realize that although it invites you to project a rising Aristotelian dramatic action onto it, which culminates in a singular climax, it actually has no such structure. The piece is constructed like a beehive, a collection of compartments conceived as more or less discrete vessels for self-generated energy and growth. Growth of anything, celebration of human ingenuity, a warning against hubris, intellectual speculations on restrictive social roles, what have you. The compartmentalization of the cells of energy and their self-sufficiency is the chief reason why the piece can tolerate spectators leaving for long periods of time without losing impact. And this is interesting as far as it goes, but to me, as I've said, the really enduring mystery of Einstein on the Beach is how it could sustain its power for so many hours without a logocentric, word-centered narrative structure. The oddity of it was that you could watch the piece for hours and hours, unsure about the particular significance of anything, but nevertheless certain that something significant and pertinent was waiting around every corner. You felt drawn into a reverie that could last indefinitely and remain indefinitely rewarding because time itself seemed as expertly manipulated as the pictures and the music and the dance. In the end, the length of the production, divided into such precisely crafted and timed sections, was like a guarantee of its rigor and its tenacity. I think that in the end, Einstein and the Beach offered a very rare experience of direct phenomenological perception in the theater. This is a really rare experience, and the critic who's spoken most eloquently about it is Susan Sontag, who wrote in her book Against Interpretation about a sensual mode of artistic response that, while it doesn't deny the intellectual, nevertheless operates at a kind of a distance from it, fostering direct appreciation of an artwork's thingness. Those are her words. The same idea could be approached through Robert Smithson's vision of minimalist sculpture in the 1960s when he spoke of timeless new monuments that, quote, bring to mind the Ice Age rather than the Golden Age and placed past and future into an objective present. You could approach the idea through William Carlos Williams' famous credo, no ideas, but in things, which was originally an apologia for a form of quintessentially American artistic naivete that was rooted in intense local experience rather than European modernist complexities. The objective strangeness of a train, a derrick, a courtroom, a rectangle of light. All these things seen as if for the first time, but not childishly, or not only childishly. Inexplicable surprise felt in a seashell, in the floating descent of a paper airplane, in the blinking of patterned lights, even in familiar images of Albert Einstein or a mushroom cloud. The possibility of that kind of direct empirical apprehension, such bright sensual contact with the thingness of a theatrical mise-en-scène, sensual contact with the literally unspeakable essential truths inside it, all of that seemed absurdly unlikely to me on the winter evening I first saw Einstein in 1984. Yet, I witnessed it for one fleeting five-hour moment. Thank you. Sure. Yes.
I share your enthusiasm and admire, but I think you're full of heart.
I'm sorry.
You're full of hot air. I'll tell you what.
Hot air.
I'm full of hot air. Oh.
Your reason is, first of all, Einstein on the Beach, you take it falls together because of Philip Glass's music. It's wonderful music. I saw it twice. Okay? It was my dream. and then you're telling me that that's good, and then last part, Mahabharata. I thought, again, it was completely nonsensical. First of all, I'm an Indian, I'm Hindu, I read it in Sanskrit. It had nothing to do with the book or the legend or whatever it meant for. It's a religious text. And then you quote Wagner, for God's sake, the worst anti-Semite ever. You know, even to think of his plays as anything, along the lines you talk about myth, enlarging man's vision of whatever the world is or things like that. It's ridiculous. He and his wife were driven by one theme, hatred of the Jews, and we didn't even mention. And then, you know, the German audience loved it because they, you know, really, oh, look at all his followers. Who were they? The worst kind of someone in the world. They brought on Hitler and the whole bunch of others. And I'm just saying this because, you know, like you're a professor, I'm just a player, I happen to be a player. And I mean, nobody.
When something doesn't reach one person and it reaches another person, there's really nothing to be said about that. However, I will say that each one of your objections to what's missing from my lecture, the anti-Semitism of Wagner and the tendency of his work to be misused by the Nazis, the boring nature of Faust as you read it, the fact that Brooks' Mahabharata was a touristic travesty of the Hindu sacred text of the Mahabharata, all of that is discussed at length in my book. You can't speak about everything in a short lecture, so I would ask you to reserve some judgment. Thank you. Yeah. Yes.
You know, I'll say two things. First, there's the obvious answer, which is that you're much more likely to be produced if you write a play that is shorter and has fewer characters in a cheaper set. That's the obvious thing. But the other thing is that I, too, don't love long theater. You know, I don't look at the listings each year and say, oh, great, there's six marathons, you know? Because most of them are going to be bad. These are high points in my life, you know, that are discussed in my book over 30 years, you know? And there's seven productions. So I've sat through some really dreadful long productions, and when I go to a theater, I ask the ushers what the running time is. And Tony Kushner, the author of The 7-Hour Angels in America, once told me that he does the same thing and is secretly thrilled when the usher says 90 minutes, no intermission. So I do think that we have to live in our time, and our time has, you know, pushed us into a certain kind of attention span. But it also leaves us with hungers that we can't assuage that way. And if we pay attention to that hunger, we will look for ways to assuage it. And if you can do that reading, God bless you. If you can do it with religion, God bless you, you know. And some people look for it in this secular temple of Western theatrical art. And the astonishing thing is that they ever find it there. And they sometimes do. Yeah.
Never. You know, one of the things that I do, because I thought it would be interesting to readers, is talk about the making of these pieces in the introductory pages of each essay. Each one of them is the fruit of such a long gestation. You know, Peter Stein
is the first person to do all of Faust uncut, 12,111 lines. That is a play that was published first in 1831, and he's the first person to do the absolutely ridiculous thing of try and do the whole thing uncut. And I had such doubts about that, but you know what? That was planned. It first went up in 2000. Those plans go back to 1978. And so you think about how much time somebody puts into trying to plot out one of these things. And then all of the workshop productions, you know, and the failures and the doubts and how often it falls apart and then it gets put back together. There's a lot of daring and a lot of trial and error, and that's just not something everybody has the stomach for. Yes, as a matter of fact, I saw Gatz so late that I could mention it only in a footnote to my book. And I regretted that because I liked it so much that I actually would have included it if I could have. And I was thrilled because a woman who edits this journal called Anglia, it's a academic journal, read my book and said, I loved your book. I want to do a special issue of Anglia on the new monumentalism, whatever that means. It means long and, you know, large size artworks. Would you contribute? And so I had an excuse to do an essay on Gatz. And so my piece for that is on Gatz. And I loved it. Well, it hasn't been published yet. She's still gathering her pieces. I think it'll be published in 2013 sometime. But if you like, I can, if you want to give me your contact, I'll send it to you. But no, I loved Gatz. Gatz, for those of you who don't know, was done in New York last year and the year before. It was a dramatization of the entirety of F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. Every word was spoken on the stage over 7 hours. Yeah, and I think that the 19th century had a kind of affection for monumentalism. It liked grand, you know, bloviated things. And Goethe really kind of laid the foundation for these outsize works with Faust II, which is twice the length of Faust I and has all these impossible stage directions. It's kind of considered a closet drama by most people, meaning only for reading. That play became kind of it incited a kind of a can you top this contest for other 19th century writers. Peer Gynt, which is a very long play by Ibsen, is in a way a kind of a Norwegian Faust, you know? there are a lot of people working in the turn of the 20th century avant-garde, like Paul Claudel and the Satin Slipper, who are distantly referencing Faust, competing with him in a kind of anxiety of influence way. So it's not one thing. It's a kind of a string of things that dares the theater to find a means to produce these unreasonably impractical texts. And there's always somebody around who says, oh, you call it impractical, well, I can do it. You know, whether you want to see it is another question. Yeah?
It was a couple of Gatz sort of presupposed. My question was, which was, if you were to write a second volume, what are the other productions that you weren't able to include in the first volume?
You know, I tell you, the one thing that I really wanted do and couldn't figure out how to fit in was to write about Mnuchin. She is, I think, a brilliant theater maker. And I've seen several really long pieces by her that also worked this magic for me. I saw Les Atrides, which came here in 1992, I mentioned. It was, and we also saw Le Dernier Caravanserai, and what else did we see? Yeah, Les FM. Anyway, my problem was that I wanted each of the chapters in my book to deal with a different kind of marathon theater. And I couldn't figure out how to talk about what I appreciated in Mnuchin in a way that was really categorically different from Peter Brook. They're too similar, you know, and so it was either one or the other. So if I was to do another volume, I would find a way to fit her in, I would find a way to fit Gatz in, you know. There's a lot of things I would do.
You never mentioned Oberon again.
Right.
Was there a reason or not?
I think that, speaking of anti-Semitism, that Oberammergau is a kind of a perverse event.
Yes.
It's hard for me to celebrate the continuation of Oberammergau because it's had this really awful history. And so has the Wagnerism. So I would never want to aggrandize that. The truth is that the Corpus Christi celebrations were also occasions for persecution of Jews. So But to single out Oberammergau, which is so close to our time and has this kind of poisonous thing, while I'm trying to sort of channel my nostalgia for the communal togetherness of these medieval people, it just didn't work tonally, you know?
Would you consider Andy Warhol in the category of...
Andy Warhol's a very interesting example, because Andy Warhol made these eight-hour films of just someone sleeping, or just a camera directed at the Empire State Building and so on. And in a way, this kind of reality film, you know, is an anticipation not only of our fascination with reality TV, but I think it also anticipates the avant-garde work of something like Elevator Repair Service and Forced Entertainment, which is a similar company I do write about in my book, where they also are using the chance events and coincidences of what is happening along the 6 or 7 hour period of time that isn't completely pre-planned. So although Warhol keeps it simple, he is kind of a game changer in forcing people to broaden their definition of what they might think about in this category of art.
To me, it seems more authentic in a way. What I'm trying to say is he doesn't have any intellectual pretense. Yeah.
So, that's true.
Yeah. So, yeah. So you mean, you just go with it all.
Yeah. Well, okay, thank you very much.
So we do have books for sale, so feel free to buy a copy and come to the front, and Dr. Cobb will happily sign one.